Now here's May with part two.
Okay, it's very important to know, as I say, that Los Angeles Times had an article on these condominiums down there that the president and the FBI or the Congress that approve of these people don't know that the attorney for Richard Nixon, the deputy attorney for Richard Nixon under John Dean, becomes the attorney for Nancy and Ronald Reagan, and that he in turn shares an apartment with the national security advisor down in Florida, who has been involved with the Lockheed scandal with payoffs over there. His name was involved in the Lockheed scandal. His name was involved with Robert Vesco at the height of Watergate in the IT scandal. That he has an apartment in an area that was bought from a man, Mr. Butello, who was working in the Azores with Robert Vesco, and that the Japanese newspapers know that some other big president was transacted through Richard Allen. Now, do these presents go from Richard Allen to Nancy Reagan, or I'm sure they just don't go to Allen. So who is the man in charge of the accounting of what goes in and out of the Reagan's house, what they borrow, and what gifts they get? It's the Fox. It's Fred Fielding. Now, he was the person at time of Watergate that was in charge of the most sensitive papers of Watergate. He was the person in charge of E. Howard Hunt's desk, the Chappaquiddick papers, the forging of papers blaming John Kennedy for murdering Diem in Southeast Asia, the papers of Dr. Lewis Fielding's office, the Ellsberg papers, all the dirty tricks, the Chappaquiddick. They were in charge of Chappaquiddick, and this kind of sensitive, dirty trick that involved murder. There was Diem murdered, Mary Jo Kopechne murdered, John Kennedy murdered. They obviously, and then the ITT scandal, they were obviously into the dirtiest areas of espionage. And Fred Fielding and John Dean were the ones who suggested deep sixing the material, pouring it into the river, emptying out the desk of E. Howard Hunt, and just leaving a few innocuous papers around. Even at the time of the ITT scandal, when there were things that John Mitchell and Robert Mardian didn't know, the Attorney General and head of the Justice Department, John Dean and Fred Fielding knew and destroyed. They shredded, they tore up, they sunk, they burned things, top papers that would overthrow the people in power today and expose the corruption in this country to the highest level. These are the things that if the agents of the Secret Service are listening to tonight, that I really resent and get very angry about, that certain people who had access to those very top secret documents go on then to be accountable for what's going on in the White House today after destroying material in the criminal case where there was actually burglaries and taking away our democratic process in those offices. Now, there was another important article this week that had to do with a war with Syria that the United States wanted to have 6 months ago, and I'll get to that in a minute. But part of the article goes on to say that the State Department is so messed up, the National Security Council is the poorest and least effective in the last quarter of a century, that they had to get rid of Richard Allen. But it says Allen was forced out not because he accepted $1,000 for a Japanese magazine for setting up an interview with Nancy Reagan, but because he was an ineffective administrator who put together the national security staff. Now, the very fact that there is in print today that it had nothing to do with the money and the photograph of Nancy Reagan is the first time I've seen in print that, because I know that that is the truth. That little envelope that said $1,000 or $100,000 was just a little bit of a tip of a huge scandal. The story of this one is that the Pentagon now has option papers drawn up by the National Security Council that the White House wanted a war with Syria last spring. I knew when Sadat was murdered that they could achieve a lot of things at one time. We could get all our troops into the Middle East immediately. We're going to pour into there, sell the AWACS to Saudi Arabia, introduce Arafat to Japan and make him a statesman for the first time recognized by the free world, scare everybody that Gaddafi could have been behind this, and get our army and troops out there any way we could in the Middle East. It didn't work. Our allies didn't go for it, and we went against it. But the second point about the plans to make the war and to bomb Syria and begin a war is that if they used our airplanes, United States airplanes, it would be considered a unilateral act of war. So what they were going to do was to use Israel and give them the green light to wipe out the Syrian missiles, and that would begin World War III. Can you imagine the National Security Council is going to give the Jews the opportunity to start World War III? I knew when they bombed Iraq or the missile planes there that they didn't do a thing without the advice of the United States. A small country like Israel wouldn't dare do it unless they're told to do it. And we're trying to get a response from these people so we have an excuse to get into that Persian Gulf. But Israel would be given the green light under the table. This was part of the agreement. And it says one of the men in the National Security Council from Indiana University, this Raymond Tanter, is considered strongly, even passionately, pro-Israeli. So he loves Israel so much that they'll say, you go ahead and start it, and then we'll come in later. So the war with Syria was proposed last spring, and all that brahu about a possible war in the Middle East could have developed into a real war in the Middle East. Now, to update you on the Pan Am flight, the competition between Man American and Air America, and a little bit more last week, 1.5 hour, I did an analysis of what I thought were the important points of the airplane that went into the Potomac River in Washington, D.C. On the sheet from the broadcast, for those of you who get the tapes, I put in there possible motive for all major airlines, the East and the South, are losing competition to Air Florida. The Pan Am is going broke. I said, see, Edward Acker, who built Air Florida, left in September for Pan America. Pan America and major airlines didn't like the competition of this very successful Air Florida. Well, just this week in the newspaper, this is January the 30th, yesterday, Pan Am reports a net loss of $18.8 million. I didn't have the figures. Pan American World Airways said yesterday they had their $18 million loss, and they announced a 6% cut in their staff and management. Five of the present 32 presidents will be downgraded. One vice president is going to be dismissed. 200 management people will be fired. 3,200 people in all will be fired. Chairman C. Edward Acker said the working day for remaining managerial employees will be 10 hours, up to 10 hours a day, and their vacation time will be halved to fill in the gaps. So Pan Am is under a loss, and the person that I mentioned who made Air Florida so successful, C. Edward Acker, moved to Pan Am, and they are in deep trouble. Old Melvin Belli opened his offices here in Monterey, and I think I mentioned before he was going to do that. He has offices in Los Angeles and San Francisco. He was on the evening news interviewed, and they asked him a question about John Kennedy's assassination because Belli represented Jack Ruby in that trial, and he said, well, the Secret Service was lax, and so the fellow just happened to get there and get his shot, still holding the Oswald story. It'd be awfully nice, being as Melvin Belli will be in the community sometimes, and Mae Brussel is here, to have a debate maybe at the Sunset Theater or at MPC and have Melvin Belli defend the Warren Commission and Jack Ruby in his position as his attorney, and let me publicly debate with Melvin Belli. I have a feeling the city is just almost too small for Mae Brussel and Melvin Belli. I would just love to have a quiet discussion, not a newspaper media thing that he has, on the evidence of the conspiracy and the role of Jack Ruby with organized crime and with the military and the Genovese family and the CIA and the links of Ruby to the higher conspiracy. Well, Melvin Belli is going to represent the as many of the people who want to sue and break the back of Air Florida as he can. He evidently, somebody from his office placed an ad. This is in the San Francisco Examiner. Belli, who's East Coast representative, placed an ad in the Washington Post last week seeking clients among families of the victims of the airplane crash, the Air Florida 90. Melvin Belli promises to sue everybody who's even remotely responsible for the crash, and he'll ask large sums, and he wants to represent those people. Now, there were a lot of military people on that plane, and I've gone over the list of some of them, and a lot of, I'm sure there must be with them, intelligence or CIA. Belli had to be with the CIA to represent Jack Ruby because all the Warren Commission and staff and people around the assassination were in the intelligence community. So he's going to build a large suit on the fact of the air solvent on the wings, and he's taking the position that the ice and the solvent wasn't sufficient to let the plane get off the ground. He's going to get as many people, as many cases, and wrap that up into a big case, and it's a very controversial one. The same week after the accident, there was an article on the conflict of the Army and the Rapid Deployment Forces. Large article. The Army rivalry cost the United States a lot of money in national security. One in the Washington Post, one in the San Jose Mercury. The Army and the Marines go to war. And this article is about the fact that all four services of the military are angry at the Rapid Deployment Force. They fought 2 years to control the Rapid Deployment Force, the Army and the Marines, and they want high priority primarily to protect the Persian Gulf oil supplies. And this is about a fight of the Army services among each other against the Special Command Forces and the Rapid Deployment. Well, on that particular airplane, there were three from the Rapid Deployment Force and two from the Readiness Command that went down on that particular plane. I'm sure they must travel in this way. They weren't on vacation. They were on assignment from the military, and I don't know whether these particular seven people were part of the conflict, but just this week there were long articles about the conflict of the branches of the service, and seven people from right of the heart of this conflict were on that particular plane, and now we have Melvin Belli as their attorney. Incidentally, Air Florida put in a bid to buy Western Airlines before the crash took place, and evidently this has been approved, so they're not that broke. Maybe the lawsuits will stop them, or maybe they were allowed to buy so that if they overpay on the claims that Belli will try to get for each of these people, then they won't be able to follow through with their purchase on Western Airlines. I don't know what their cash is, but this week they were able to take over Western Airlines, and Pan Am and the older airlines are going broke. Now, there was some more mystery. I mentioned last week the paramedic, Gene Windsor, who was told not to identify the man who was sinking. He was told, don't cooperate with the news media or attempt to identify him by viewing photographs shown by news organizations. And I didn't understand why the Washington police were so insistent that a witness who saw a man sink into the water, this Arlen Williams, he thought it was told not to identify him. Well, there was another long article in the Washington Post, January the 20th. The plane crash hero remains a mystery, and it goes into the a point of all the mysteries surrounding the crash of Air Florida jet. The most puzzling is the identity of the unknown passenger seen by the helicopter crew. And this article goes into why this mystery. Yesterday, the mystery only deepened, and they can't figure out one gentleman who survived, the last person to get on the airplane who worked for Fairchild. They had waited till he had boarded. Just said, I didn't see such a passenger. He denied that this person was floating there and fell into the sunk into the frozen water. And another version accounted that he did in fact go that way and that they saw him. And another person confirmed two helicopter crews saw this person. And there's quite a bit of controversy. It's interesting. Joseph Stiley worked for Fairchild. He survived. He was the last one on. And he said, he was talking about this Mr. Williams and whether it was him or not that went sinking in the water, the man who helped three or four people first. And he said his main concern was to pass a lifeline to Priscilla Tirado. She was the one who should get out first as far as I was concerned. Now, Tirado was the one whose husband worked for George Bush. They'd recently come over from Madrid. And 1 month after he came from Madrid, he was working at Masonry and so forth at the home of Vice President Bush. And Mr. Stiley from Fairchild said the one that he was concerned was to get, she was the one that should get out first. And there was still a lot of controversy up to the present about that particular person and why they didn't want him to be identified, or what was the objection to persons giving information of what they saw. Another article on the crash data, the little black box was retrieved. We were told as soon as they found that, they went diving for 3 days, we'd know all the secrets. And when they finally got the box, it didn't say anything. They went airborne, the plane took off, and it was airborne less than 30 seconds, and that was the last that the air controllers ever heard of it. Frances McAdams, the National Transportation Safety Board, refused to speculate on the acceleration. There were too many problems. They don't know why it didn't accelerate, and they don't know why the takeoff didn't take place. They said in the San Francisco Examiner this week, we may never know the results. You know, we're told we'll know the results as soon as they play it back on the box. And then they say there's some things you may never know. It's like when they begin the investigation of who killed John Kennedy or the Watergate hearings. We'll have the whole truth so the country will be free and know the truth. And then they conclude by saying there's things you may never know. So the result of the National Transportation Board this week is we may never know. We sent the flight data to the Boeing company in Seattle, and when they return it to Federal Aviation, we will decide whether or not to release it. So evidently, the plane just went off, and it wasn't long. Air Florida tapes, when they first were made public, there wasn't a word of the pilot. There wasn't a last word. There wasn't any cussing or anything. They were cleared for takeoff, and the tape was in good condition, and they yelled, the air controller said after 69 seconds, Palm 90, Air Florida. There was no answer. It didn't appear on the radar, and he waited for 4 minutes. Hey, guy, hey, guy. 4 minutes is a long time, 4 minutes and 20 seconds. There wasn't any trace, any sound, and then he told a pilot of a U.S. Airjet plane to go out there and look for 737, and the U.S. Army jet went to the end of the runway, and there was no sight of Flight 90. And by then, somebody was over at the Potomac. But there was no record. There was just dead silence. And usually on these tapes, the pilot will say, oh, remember when he cussed or we're going down, and they make some comment or you hear some noise. It was just total silence. It's interesting. They did autopsies on 74 victims. They didn't do more than six at Jonestown. There were over 900 dead. They claimed autopsies on 74 victims and said 57 died almost instantly, and some had injuries, and quite a few had injuries on the head. And there was a question, well, if they had on seat belts and they were only out 30 seconds, you know, if they're held by the seat belts, how could their heads have been hurt? Even on impact, the plane didn't crash down on their heads. But they did autopsies on 74 for some reason or other that I can't figure out, and I think it's a little confusing. They also had trouble. One reason they didn't want to identify all the passengers, they identified one person as Spencer Hazelwood, and that was this person was brought up as Spencer Hazelwood, but he went under the name of a T. Pibbs. The ticket was to T. Pibbs, P-I-B-B-S. And actually, it was Spencer Hazelwood who had used a ticket of somebody by another name, which was kind of interesting. There's a man in jail, if he's still alive, who hypnotized his best friend and the plane put a bomb on a plane that blew up over the Gulf of Texas, out in the water outside of New Orleans in the bay of that area. And then this fella drove an old used car back to his wife in Texas, and she collected the insurance money, and then they found him, and he had put somebody on the plane going on his name, and he actually was safe on the ground. Well, the first passenger list said Mr. T. Pibbs died, but later that was Hazelwood, and so much for that. I did mention last week that Mr. Tirado, working as a cement mason at George Bush's house, and I think I mentioned to you before, but in case I didn't, I wanted to remind you that when Joseph Mengele was in this country, that's the Nazi doctor who experimented at Auschwitz, who lives down in Paraguay and comes frequently to the United States. According to the FBI report, he masquerades as a construction worker. So even Joseph Mengele does a little cement work on the side, and that's kind of interesting. Now, there was a lot of controversy. The United States Senate has asked the federal government to go into that other airplane, the World Airways. That crash that slid off the edge of the runway there in Boston, Massachusetts. There were several shocking things about that plane, and that was that as the jet plunged into the harbor, they insisted on the first day that all 208 people were safe, the DC-10. When they went off the runway, and this was January 24th, all 28 were safe, and they declared the next day everyone that was on the plane was safe. And then it took several days later, 3 days later, when they reported that two people were missing. And some witnesses saw a person hanging in the water about 25 feet away go under. And later there was luggage, hand luggage that was on the plane. And the Coast Guard, the shocking thing was an article in the Associated Press, January 29th, that the Coast Guard went under the airplane and the Coast Guard men spotted a body in the wreckage in the forward section of the airplane, but they didn't bring it back up because the Coast Guard was told that all the passengers were there. Now, that is a little unbelievable to read an article over the wire service, is that the Coast Guard, no matter what they were told, you would think that they would bring the body up if they see a body in the water or want to know whose body. Here is a body in the plane, and they're told, no, everyone's accounted for, and they didn't bring the body up. And members of the family called World Airways and said that their father and brother were on that plane, and World Airways said, go to the police and file a missing persons report. And it took several days to admit that there are other witnesses who saw this. Donald Welsh, a dental student from Tufts University, recalled seeing the Metcalfs in the front row. The seat disappeared. He saw somebody floundering 25 feet to the left, and the person disappeared under the water. They told a firefighter. They told policemen at the airport at the time of the crash. They called up World Airways a few days later. World Airways couldn't deny it because they found the luggage. And then finally, the officials, the government officials, got a little tough. And the Massachusetts authority discovered after the luggage that they had to report who was on the plane. So they demanded that the airline, World Airlines, give them a list of who's on the plane. They wanted the passenger records of World Airlines. The Massachusetts lieutenant governor requested it immediately, asked for a congressional inquiry into this, and said, the Civil Aeronautics said by January 28th, you have to submit your flight coupons and your boarding passes by today, by January the 28th. Your boarding passes and your flight coupons. And so then they pulled out the boarding passes of the two men, Mr. Metcalf, who's 79 or 80, and whose son, who's 40, they'd been in Florida, and they went to New Jersey and picked up this plane. The plane started in Oakland, California, to New Jersey, to Boston. They went from Florida to New Jersey and were going to pick it up and go to Boston, and they found that, admitted that Mr. Metcalf and their son were on the plane. Now, the important thing in this story is that after insisting that they had to submit those coupons, it took them 4 days to find the coupons that the men went through the boarding pass. Why did World Airways say they weren't there? Why did the Port Authority say everyone was accounted for? Why did the firemen and the police get involved in the cover-up? And then when they admitted that they had their passenger passes, they said that the computer wasn't working, that they were relying on the computer, and the two tickets of those two men weren't on the computer. Now, to match the computer not having those two passengers, having 208 people, but not having the passenger's name, and having those two people be the ones that are missing, the ones that weren't on the computer, the mathematical chances of that are really almost impossible. So the next question is, well, who is Mr. Metcalf or his son? Or were they drugged in New Jersey so that in case there anything happened, they wouldn't be able to get out of it, or they would sink, or not be able to protect themselves? What were they doing in Miami? Who did they know in Miami? Who did they see in New Jersey? Why did they go this time of year? Why did World Airways wait 4 days? Every time you go through the gate to get on an airplane, you have to show your boarding pass when you go through the first door, when they open the door. You have to take your boarding pass and put it in the hands of the stewardess, and then she turns them over and the airplane door is closed. So it would only take about 10 minutes to go through those names. And if they could add them all up, then they had the names. Otherwise, they would have added 206. But what was World Airways covering here? Why did Boston Airport get involved in it? Why the local police and the fire department? And why didn't the Coast Guard bring up the body that was there that they saw? Just because they were told everyone was accounted for, they could have brought up that body at the time. And so, therefore, there must have been something there in that story that we'll have to wait a much longer to find out about. Now, next week, I want to do a little more on Poland because we hear so much about Solidarity and what's going on in Poland. I did do quite a bit. This was January the 3rd, 4 weeks ago. Poland this week is blaming the CIA for unrest in Poland. That's the gist of what I was talking about, the AFL-CIO that is the CIA and the troublemakers in Poland forming the Solidarity in 1980. This week, there were pictures on the news. You probably saw them. They took in Poland pictures of people that worked for the American embassy that were in the political section that were working for CIA and other parts of the world before, and it showed their arrest, a particular woman, Leslie Sternberg, with brochures and secret ink and secret leaflets, and another person who worked at the American embassy, a residence where a stone was placed and messages under the stone. And then they pulled them out, and they had a shaving brushes with microphones in them and all kinds of espionage, ink pellets, hollow shaving brushes, cameras, radios. And they were passing information inside of a stone that was picked up outside a plant. It was information on Poland's air defense systems. So the newsreels showed the charges. The Poland blames the unrest on the CIA and how they not only are causing trouble, but photographing the installations. And I want to do more on the AFL-CIO. George Bush, January the 20th, this last week, accepted an invitation from the AFL-CIO Lane Kirkland to address their midwinter executive meeting in Bull Harbor, Florida. He's going to be part of the AFL-CIO meeting in February. This is Vice President Bush. He was in charge of the Polish desk with Richard Pipes and Walter Stessel and the entire Cold War team from the Eastern Division, the Galen men that worked so closely together. Again, there was a movie made on Poland by Mr. Charles Wick of the CIA, of the great communications Radio Free Europe and the American network. Ronald Reagan put on a show. This last week, he used Frank Sinatra and Barbara Streisand. And then on the designated day, it was to be in conjunction with the AFL-CIO meeting in Chicago that Lane Kirkland set up. The movie production that Ronald Reagan made for $500,000 with the fellow who produces the Academy Awards, this outrageous piece of junk that's been criticized by our allies, this propaganda movie that was thrown over the satellites on Poland to make showbiz out of something that was and is very serious. This was arranged in conjunction with Mr. Kirkland of the AFL-CIO, and George Bush will be addressing them in February, so it's timely that I do an update on the Polish situation and the role of AFL-CIO in Guatemala, Nicaragua, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Chile, wherever labor tries to get organized, how they put in the fascist state and the role I have done, as I say, broadcasts on the role that they have in setting up Solidarity in Poland. Next week, hopefully, I'll get into their role into the Marseille connections with the narcotic hoodlums and their links to the Red Brigade and the terror on the right. I'll do more on Dozier. I didn't bring him up before because the Red Brigade is so heavily tied into the extreme right-wing fascist group, and I believe that that giant hoax should be exposed, and hopefully I'll do more than that on that next week. But the AFL-CIO, George Bush, and Frank Sinatra and Charles Wick and the gang are pushing up the media show business thing on Poland, which doesn't solve the problems of the economy, the debt, the productivity, the road to go forward. They can't go forward with the Americans pumping money into their unrest. There's no solution to it. And there's no sensible effort to really make their system workable. We want the chaos so that we have the excuse to come in. And when we get there, we'll have more problems than we can imagine. Well, my time is up now. Once more, I have to say goodbye until next week. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and I'll be back with you next week.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Brussel. This program originates from Carmel, California.
Tenakwe, hare mai. This is Neil Finn and
Tim Finn
from Split Ends on KLRB Carmel.